And good morning, everyone, or good evening, or good afternoon, whatever the case may be. And welcome to this rotating planetary experience we call the Other Side of Midnight. That magical time between dusk and dawn when someone is calling the station from the middle of the Nevada desert, 100 miles, give or take, to Flagstaff, heading toward the east, toward Arizona. All of that, of course, is a kind of a tease to what we're going to be trying to do here in a moment. Let me go to Skype and see if we... No, it looks like we have lost our connection. We're going to try to connect tonight with James Goodall, who, as you may remember, is our now resident expert on Area 51, the leading authority. He is a novelist. He's an author of many, many, many nonfiction books on the Area 51, the Blackbird, aerospace, exotica, et cetera, et cetera. And we're trying to bring him in from the road because he was positioned at the Area 51 invasion this past week and this weekend. And they broke up a bit early. And so we're going to get a live report from him shortly. And we won't know until we make some connections whether we're going to have a connection. In the meantime, let me give you a couple of items that I want to make sure we don't forget for the rest of the evening. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, that's our homepage, click on that, and that banner up there, which talks about the Alternative Space Program with my two guests tonight, Michael Schratt and James Goodall, click on the banner. That will take you to the guest page for tonight. Scroll down to Radio with Pictures. Item number one. Update on Chandrayaan-2. Remember, about a week and a half ago, the Indian government tried to land the Vikram lander in the Chandrayaan-2 mission, the unmanned mission to the moon, the second unmanned mission for the Indian government. And everything was working fine up until a few moments before landing. They were less than a mile up, and then something happened. Actually, it happened twice. And then just before touchdown, the Indians lost connection with their lander called Vikram. And they've been trying for the last several many days, almost now 2 weeks, to contact it by means of radio. There are reports coming out of India that the orbiter, the Chandrayaan-2 orbiter, which is in great condition, orbiting about 60 miles up, it looked down with its cameras and spotted the region where the Vikram lander was supposed to have touched down. There was one report that I have not been able to verify that says on the very high resolution images that are shot from the orbiter, which are capable of showing things as small as 1 foot, 3/10 of a meter, 1 foot. Well, with that resolution, they apparently got an image of the Vikram lander sitting on the surface, kind of looking intact, although the report did say that it was tilted, and that implies a very hard landing with shock absorbers breaking on one side, and they've been trying ever since to send radio signals to it from the Earth, and there has been nothing but a deafening silence. Now, in a couple of 3 weeks, we're going to have a show, another moon show, with our team, with the Enterprise Imaging team. And the reason we're holding off a bit is because, A, we have no surface imagery from Chandrayaan-2. We do have some orbital shots. We have some astonishing orbital shots. And based on the analysis and comparison of those data with the equally amazing images that were shot by the Bereshit mission. Remember, the Israelis in April tried their own private landing, and it also went haywire in the last minute or two, and it crashed much higher speed than the hard landing of Vikram. So when you compare the images of the moon shot by both the spacecraft of the lunar limb, the curving edge of the moon as seen from lunar orbit, there are some very remarkable, in fact, astonishing things to be seen. And it's those details in the Chandrayaan compared to the Bereshit orbital images that now inform us here at Enterprise as to what happened to the Indian landing spacecraft. They hit the glass. And we're going to give you much more details with actual imagery, with actual data, with actual graphs from the official broadcast by Vikram as it was landing back to the Indian Control Center in India. And we put all this together, and we know what happened to the Vikram lander. And lo and behold, if you go back and listen to some earlier shows in the last several months as we talked about this mission upcoming, we predicted that what happened to the Vikram lander was actually going to happen. And why? And I know that all sounds like a huge tease. Well, frankly, it is. So we will put up placards and blogs and posts and notifications of when we're going to do this next moon show, because one of the things we're working on is a 3D computer model of the moon that both Bereshit and Vikram, and of course all the other missions to the moon from the US and the USSR and the Japanese have encountered in previous eras, and no one has told you what they really saw. So you're going to want to stay tuned for that. Switching gears, item number 2 in Radio with Pictures under my items tonight. We've got a couple of stories there. Well, one story on the Storm Area 51 activity. And as a matter of fact, why don't we go to Jim right now and see if we can pick him up. Mr. Goodall, are you there? And I do not hear him. So, James Goodall. Jim, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I'm here. I've done your intro, so tell us where you are and what has been happening, and how did the Storm Area 51 event take place?
Okay, I'm about 85 miles from Flagstaff on Interstate 40. And we were there. Stuart Brown and I headed off to NICO, Nevada, to be part of the Storm Area 51 base camp. And it was, George Harris put out a lot of money, and because there were so many reports that everything had been canceled, a lot of people didn't show up. But we had about 400 people at the base camp, and they estimate somewhere maybe 1,000, mostly scattered in the desert near Rachel. There was only one arrest. It was right at the gate of Area 51, the main road, the back road. And some yahoo decided in front of a cop, he was an unzipped his pants and watered down the gate, but he got arrested for indecent exposure.
Oh, well, we know how he wanted to go down in history.
Right, right. It was fun. It was, Pat Travis was tickled to see us because we helped put Pat on a little alien on the map. And but Pat had the kitchen closed. And she was charging $7 for a can of Budweiser.
Oh, good God. The end of the world is going to be a monetary event. I can see it now.
Right, right. And some guy was complaining. I said, well, you should have known you're in the middle of absolutely nowhere. What makes you think that Pat Travis, who has the only retail establishment within 50 or 100 miles, that she wouldn't charge an arm and a leg for something you would? It's called supply and demand.
Yep.
You're in the middle of nowhere. You had a demand for a beer. She had the supply. Good for Pat. I know Pat since 87. Her and her late husband, Joe.
So nobody was killed, thank God.
Nobody was killed. The weather was absolutely perfect. it was the mid-80s, high 70s, depending on where you were. There were probably more law enforcement in the area than there were participants and revelers.
I saw some video on Fox, I think. They were carrying George Knapp, because I think that's the local Fox affiliate there in Las Vegas. Anyway, I saw a whole bunch of people who looked like aliens themselves. It looked like everybody with a costume drove from Los Angeles to the middle of the Nevada desert.
Yeah, there was a ton of people there, and I just hope I don't get a ticket. I'm just getting ready to go by a cop. I've been doing 85. So maybe it's not a cop. Maybe it's a fire truck. Okay. I feel better. It's not a cop.
Well, that would be a new radio first on live radio.
Oh, yeah. So we had a good time. Everybody went out of their way to do the best they could. I felt sorry for a lot of the vendors. The store, the Base Camp store did a gold rush of business. I mean, they had a line of people outside. This is George Harrison's place in Nico, where we stayed. There was a line of people almost for 2 days, the 3 days we were there. And so he did well that way, but he funded everything. I mean, there was a band last night. There was a disc jockey. There was all sorts of, I mean, he really did an incredible job, and I think they're going to do it again next year. So this is Alien Fest 1, and it's like Burning Man was. First time they had Burning Man, maybe there was 150 people.
When Burning Man was a real amateur effort in the desert.
Correct.
And then it went to total corporate insanity. Well, it sounds like a new tradition has started, and you know, I'm just glad that nobody died, and I'm not really saying that tongue in cheek.
Yeah, and no one got hurt.
Yep.
I mean, there were no snake bites, there were no scorpion bites, there was nothing. There was no use for probably 40 or 50 EMT type vehicles and people in the area. I mean, they were ready. I mean, they were armored personnel carriers down there. It was pretty amazing the amount of hardware that they had just in case.
Well, when this thing went wide on Facebook, there were something like 2 million responses that said, you know, be there or be square.
Right. Well, then the response went out. It's been canceled.
Yeah, you and I talked earlier in the week, and I said, "Are you still going?" Because I thought it was canceled, and I was confused myself. So no wonder most people stayed home. Very smart, very wise.
Right. But it was still fun, and it's the beginning of a trend. I don't know if I'll go back next year. If I'm invited, I will. George Harris and most everybody that heard me talk really want me back. I only had about 10 minutes to talk. Jeremy was doing too much talking for my good. It was his party. It was his party, so I had to let him talk.
Well, one thing people need to understand is that there were several people who started this, you know, internet thing, and the guy who did it, he's the one who said that he was canceling his participation, and I guess a lot of people assumed that if he was pulling out, the whole thing was going to go away, which is why they didn't show up.
Correct. I mean, and there was probably more road traffic on Nevada 375, which is the extraterrestrial highway, than they've seen in probably 20 years.
Well, let me ask you the big question. You're all out there in the desert. Area 51 is just a few miles away. You're looking into its airspace. Did anybody see anything?
There was a temporary flight restriction. There was nothing there except for one medevac helicopter. That was the only thing. They sent most everybody at Area 51 that normally works there. They sent them home Wednesday or Thursday, just so that if for some reason the protesters, the gate crashers were going to be successful, they didn't want these people to be involved or in harm's way. So they were being good stewards that way.
Hmm. So did they pay them, or did they have to take time off without pay?
No, I doubt seriously they. It's the federal government. It's our tax money. They paid them. You don't send a civilian contractor or whatever home because of a protest and not pay them.
Hmm.
I mean, if it's been a private entity, then they probably said, "Well, I can't afford to pay you." But being it's Uncle Kenny with the big purse, they'll pay him.
Oh, well, at least one group been made out from this little event.
Well, when I talked to a lot of the law enforcement guys, and I said, "Well, what do you think?" And he said, "My God, I get all this overtime. What's not to like? There's nothing going on. There's nobody speeding. Nobody getting drunk. Nobody sniping anybody. Everybody is either hunkered down in their house because they don't want to be near this place, or they're just there for a good time." There was the people at the base camp. We were wandering, Stuart and I were wandering through, and there was a group of Mexican guys from San Diego. They couldn't have been more cordial. "Hey, sit down, sit down. Hey, you want a beer? You want this? You want that? What can I get you?"
And oh, terrific.
It was a wonderful experience. And the only people I felt bad for because of the low attendance were the vendors. But like one guy said, "We've been screwed by the best."
So
that's what these guys do. Not just guys, but men and women.
Well, I mean, if she was charging $7 for a beer, I mean, how do you go broke at those rates?
Right. But this was in Rachel. I don't think they were charging that much. I don't drink, so I don't know. I don't think they were charging that much at the base camp. But the guys that were really complaining were the ones that were in Rachel. In Rachel. And you had no alternative. You couldn't go into Ash Springs and buy a six-pack, or you couldn't go into Alamo and buy a six-pack. You're in Rachel, the closest town.
So did they have kind of an organized program? Do they have music and speakers and all that at the base camp?
Yeah. They had a professional stage. They had a professional production crew. They had incredible, lights and sound. My God, I swear when they were testing the speakers, you could probably hear them in Las Vegas. It was that loud.
Hmm.
I mean, they were 110 miles away.
You know, it's kind of too bad. It's kind of too bad that some of the guys we're going to be talking about in the rest of the show didn't show up and kind of put on an event overhead just to give them a thrill.
It would have been fun. I was hoping they would get an F-117 on a Tonopah test range and just fly over Typical Valley and fly over Nico. Just so we have something to go ooh and ah about.
Well, I'm glad you made it there. I'm glad you enjoyed yourself, and I'm glad you're on the way home. I'll tell you what I'm going to ask you to do. Since you know him much better than I do, I think, why don't you introduce our next guest? We got about 10 minutes to the bottom of the hour.
You're talking about Michael?
I'm talking about Michael.
Michael is sort of my replacement. I'm getting up there in age. I've been doing this for 40 years. The only person with young blood that has taken up the banner to go in and dig and poke and be a pain in the rear to the, you know, the people that control the secret is Michael. And an incredible job. For courteous, he's your young, clean-cut guy on the planet, they're Michael Schrat. And that's why you describe him. And he has a passion for spooky things and things that go bump in the night. Only his passion is only a slight bit less than mine.
How did you guys meet?
I think he sent me an email, and I sent him an email, and we talked on the phone. And next thing I know, he got a contract job in Oral Valley, Arizona, where I call home. And Michael is always welcome at my house. My wife adores him. And he always calls before he comes over, which is unusual for most people. They just sort of, oh, I'm here. So he's a great kid. Not a kid. I mean, he's an adult man, but he's a great guy. And I think the world of him. And I give him enough encouragement for what he's done and what he's going to do. Now, I'm not going to slow down, even though he is my replacement. And what we need are more Michael Schratts out there. So, in your audience that's listening and really wants to do something interesting, start digging. When someone says no, don't take no for an answer. Continue to dig. And the way I got to work with that today,
I think we're losing him. Jim?
Hey, pardon?
Yeah, I think we're losing you. Why don't I bring on Michael and you guys can talk for a couple minutes till we get to the bottom of the hour. Michael Schratt, this is your life.
Jim, thank you for the kind introduction, Jim.
It says on my board he's still there, but...
He's still there? Okay.
I don't hear him. You know, he's in those mountains on Route 40. Ah, there he is. I hear road noise. Jim, you with us?
Yeah, I lost you for a second. Michael's one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet, period.
Well, from your elevated age, everybody's a kid.
Pretty much. The only time I wasn't, when I was a restoration manager at the Museum of Flight, almost everybody that worked in the restoration center was in their mid to late 70s to 90s. We even had a guy that was 100. And it was the only time in my late adult life that I was called the kid. That doesn't happen very often.
So, Michael, you got any questions you want to ask Jim in his trekking explorations back from safe from the crowds of Area 51?
What does the sky look like, Jim?
Good question.
What does the sky look like?
Yeah, what does the sky look like right now?
When we were there, it was visibility unlimited.
Not a cloud in the sky.
And when we got there on Thursday, the wind was blowing about 40 miles an hour.
That's no fun.
That real fine talcum powder dust over absolutely everything. And other than that, and the fact that they forgot to tell us where the heater controls were in the RV that we were staying in, and it got down into, I think, the high 30s, froze our butts off. But we made it through the night. First thing in the morning, I found the heater controls. So from that point forward, we were fine.
So this base camp, they set up a special situation, brought in power and food trucks and band equipment and electronics and all that in the middle of – where was base camp actually? And did we lose him? Boy, you know, that reminds me. So many times Robin and I would drive that road from California across Nevada into Arizona. It's gives me goosebumps. So, Jim, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay.
Sound like I'm doing a commercial.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Now, I'm going to be getting, within the next half hour, 40 minutes, I'm going to be getting close to what the hell is it? Flagstaff. It's been a long day.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm gonna good night you at the bottom of the hour if we don't lose you before, because you've given us a perfect, you know, radio visual of what it was like, and it sounds like fun, and, you know, if it starts a tradition, every little bit helps. It brought a lot of public attention, a lot of national attention to the idea of what are they really doing at Area 51?
Yeah. Well, one of these days we may find out some of the stuff. But this weekend was not that time.
Well, I thought they had good sense in converting it to a party, and even better sense for most of those people to stay home, because the desert is no place to fool around with. Although it sounds to me like you're really lucked out on the weather.
The weather was the desert. It was absolutely perfect. It was high 70s, low 80s, slight breeze. No humidity. It's cool in the morning, but it was a delight. Weather-wise, it was delightful. And the people who put on the organization there at the Area 51 base camp, I couldn't ask for a more cordial go out of their way to help us. I mean, we got there. Troy came by and said, "You guys need any water?" I said, "Yeah, I could use a bottle." 2 minutes later, she brought in 10 bottles of water. I need some. Boom, they were right there. They were fantastic. And I couldn't, and George Harris and the entire production crew that put everything, all the hardware together, all the vendors. There'll be another one, and you'll make money at it this time.
Well, there won't be that confusion about, you know, is it on, is it off, is it on? That's what really, you know, actually that was kind of a blessing in disguise, because they'll now have a year to prepare and do it right.
Right. Now, the base camp, it did it right. Rachel had no clue, and they were prepared for it. They had hardly any porta potties. There were dozens of porta potties all over the place at the base camp. There was water, hand washing stations everywhere. So it was, you know, they did it right at the base camp in the area.
Okay, Jim, we're losing you. Thank you so much. Stay safe. You know, as my trucker friends used to say, you know, keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down. That was Jim Goodall reporting from the road from Area 51 invasion. When we come back, we're going to bring on Michael Schratt. We're going to have 2.5 hours of an extraordinary journey. And I want to thank Jim Goodall again and his traveling companion, and say hello to Arizona. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
OtherSideOfMidnight.com. Tune in to listen to Richard C. Hoagland and his fascinating guests. Join Club 19.5 to get access to exclusive member benefits. Listen to past episodes anytime on any device. Search the archives of over 180 episodes. Membership costs $9.95 a month, 33 cents a day. Support the broadcast that provides you with the most interesting conversation available. Talk radio at the cutting edge of science and thought. The other side of midnight.com.
And welcome back to the other side of midnight on this Saturday night, September 21st. I checked the calendar before the show, and I was going to make a big deal of the Area 51 event was coincident with the equinox, but not quite. The actual technical equinox occurs tomorrow night, actually early Monday morning at about 1:50 Land of Enchantment time, Mountain time. So we'll make a big deal about the equinox tomorrow night. Michael, are you there?
I am here, Richard.
Okay, well, it's so great to hear from Jim because, you know, we did a show with him a few weeks ago, and he gave us this extraordinary overview of Area 51 and the Blackbird and how he got into all this. And, you know, with someone with his prestige and extraordinary research skills and newspaper savvy and news kind of knows for news that he has, when he gives you the intro that he did, you know, we definitely need to take notice. So let's fill in some gaps, okay?
Sure.
Who is Michael Schratt, and how did he wind up on the radio with his good friend Jim Goodall? How did you get to be an aerospace historian?
Richard, it's an honor to be with you. I really appreciate it, Richard. I've been following your research for years from the very beginning. I love the way you lay out your stories, where you provide references, backgrounds, clippings, all the supporting evidence to back up your case. That's exactly the way I try to run it as well.
Which gainsays the question, how did you get into this strange business? I mean, we're going to be talking about technologies that most people think are out of cuckoo land. We're going to be talking about events, historical events that people think have been written by novelists. And we're going to be talking about an engineering that for most people is the nearest thing to magic that they've ever heard of. How did you become Michael Schratt, aerospace historian documenting the amazing, unbelievable stuff?
Oh, good question. Okay. Best way I can describe it is living near Chicago. There's a small town there called Marengo. And in Marengo, like in the early to mid 70s, there was an air museum. I wouldn't really call it an air museum, but it just had a bunch of old World War II derelict, dilapidated, left for dead, decrepit looking warbirds that were just kind of left to rot outside there. They had opaque canopies, The skin was cracked. The paint was peeling off. It just had this ghostly appeal.
Now, wait, this isn't the Boneyard down around Tucson,
no,
is it?
No, this isn't. Nope, this is not Tucson. This is in Marengo, Illinois.
Wow.
We're talking 1975, that time frame. And that just made such a massive impression on me. They had a PBY Catalina there. They had a P-47. And, of course, all the weeds were growing up through the wheel bells.
God.
And it just had this ghostly attraction, if you can
It must have been almost painful to see these heroes, these World War II heroes that won the war against the Nazis and the Japanese, sitting abandoned and corroding and degrading back into, I mean, kind of like looking at Martian artifacts.
That was the impression I got. It's like you're looking at an alien artifact from another world, because the ship was painted, it was faded, windshields were cracked, they had weeds growing up through the fuselage, and that's what set it off for me, Richard. That is really what got me going in my research. And then my father, over a period of about 25 years, you know, we had been going to Oshkosh, the air show there, which is the largest air show in the world, for literally 27 years in a row.
Oh, my God.
And that's how I got somewhat fluent with general aviation, experimental aircraft, warbirds. They have the classic things there, all the composite aircraft. And so it gives you a really good cross-section of what's out there. But I was always interested in what else might be out there as well. And this kind of ties in with what Jim Goodall had done, because when he was at Edwards Air Force Base, he saw some interesting birds there that changed his life forever. And that's kind of what it did for me over in Marengo. That's what started my research into aircraft, which led to kind of where we are now.
So when did you, did you wind up working in engineering or in the aerospace industry or for an aircraft company?
I've worked as a mechanical drafter for multiple different companies around the country.
Okay.
Specifically modeling up parts, drafting, bill of materials, calling vendors, and putting together packages for the FAA where you could have a supplemental type certificate and things could be installed on an aircraft after mountains of paperwork are actually filled out and approved by the FAA, then you can install it on the aircraft. So that's kind of a rough background of what I've been involved in.
So what kind of programs did you work for?
I've done commercial airliners, 747, 737, done a number of Airbus installations. So I was involved in those type programs.
Okay. Anything on the defense side?
Perhaps, yes.
Oh, we've reached that point this early in the evening. Okay. So you get to see this technology literally if you're doing illustrations and you know, what we used to call blueprints and all that. It's all CAD now. It's all computer. You're seeing this technology from the inside out.
Well, the way I would describe it is we had a big microfilm reader downstairs at one of the locations where I worked, and they had all the Boeing maintenance manuals there. And so when we would get a request for modeling up a new part, we would go downstairs, pull the microfilm, print out the station locations and stringers and bulkheads, and that tells you all the internal workings of these Boeing aircraft. And that's where you can decide where to install hardware. And that's how you get a good idea of what makes up an airliner, how it's actually constructed, all the gussets and fillets, and, you know, talking about composite aircraft being completely fully integrated. When you have an airliner made out of aluminum, it's just not the same thing. So it's just a different animal when you have an aluminum aircraft. And so from this point forward.
Well, you say it's different. How is it different?
Well,
because I'm thinking of the what is it, the 787, which is a composite, carbon fiber composite. It's not metal. It's a lot of, you know, basically plastic, although that's probably a degrading term. And they had some very huge problems with that aircraft even as recently as a year ago. And they put their problems in a steel box so it can't damage the rest of the aircraft, but they didn't solve their problem. I'm talking about the batteries, you know, basically igniting in flight, these lithium ion batteries. So what's the difference beyond that that we, as a general public
okay.
knows about, between that kind of aircraft, which is really at the cutting edge, and good old duraluminum?
Well, I'm going to try to describe this the way Burt Rutan described it in a number of lectures that he's given over the years. So let's go back to 1920. And instead of fabric, they were working with aluminum. They were working with composites. And they were using epoxies, and they were doing resin, and they were cutting out foam with a hot wire, and they were mixing in micro bubbles, micro balloons, and they were putting that over the composite structure. And
we're talking the 1920s?
Yeah, I'm talking. I'm just doing a theoretical model.
So you're kind of foreshadowing Howard Hughes and the Spruce Goose, which was this huge airplane built of wood.
Well, maybe not that, but what I'm trying to do is set an example that if instead in 1920, when we were working with tube and fabric and we were covering our planes with fabric, if we started in 1920 building aircraft out of composites, out of composite aircraft construction with fiberglass, with carbon fiber, and with resin and epoxy and all this, back in 1920, if we were doing carbon fiber in 1920, and then all of a sudden someone knocks on the door and said, I have a new material to make aircraft out of it. It's called aluminum, and we're going to make the aircraft out of aluminum, and we're going to drill holes in this, and we're going to stuff a piece of aluminum in that hole. We're going to bend it beyond its fatigue rate, and then we're going to assemble the whole aircraft like that. It would never pass through the FAA. It would never pass through the FAA, and that's kind of where we're at. We're finally getting to the point where we should be long time ago. And so that's kind of the impression that's been made, that if we started in the 1920s like this, we'd be so far ahead now.
So why was the shift made from the burgeoning, you know, fledgling composite industry mm-hmm. to cutting airplanes out of aluminum?
Well, it was aluminum first, and then it went to composites. What it should have done is it should have been composites all along. But the technology just wasn't there back then. We didn't know how to do that back then. And now we've got smooth contouring on general aviation aircraft, and that reduces the drag coefficient. We've got laminar flow back to 78% from the leading edge of the wing. And if you can keep it laminar, you can drop your drag coefficient way down. And so there's always this progress being made. There's actually a group called the Laminar Flow True Believers Society. There is such a thing called laminar flow. And if you can get that flow to be attached.
Well,
to the
I know in metal airplanes, because we started yeah. out with, you know, wire and, as you said, cloth. then there was the Spruce Goose, which was a kind of a one-time thing, building a huge airplane, the biggest in the world, out of wood. And it flew. It actually flew briefly. And then, you know, aluminum, of course, is what everybody thinks of when they think of airplanes. I know of one experiment, and I think it was done by NASA, where to get this laminar flow, where you want smooth air across the wing, no vortices, burbles, you know, imperfections in the airstream, they drilled thousands, hundreds of thousands of holes in the
right.
wing, in the leading edge, and forced
right.
air out of the wing to put a boundary layer over the wing to try to increase that laminar flow. And from my memory, I don't think those experiments were very successful, because
yeah.
the weight of the compressor to produce that laminar flow over the area of both wings was, you basically ate up all your efficiencies in the weight of the additional power system you needed.
Richard, you're talking about one of the holy grails of aviation, laminar flow control. That's really well done. That's really well done. But getting back to the composites, Burt Rutan designed something called the Starship POC, proof of concept. This is back in scale composites, 83 timeframe. That led to the Beech Starship. And I just want everyone to know that to this date, and the Starships are almost all gone. There's very few of them left flying in the world because they've all been ground up and burned away. But when it was flying, Richard, that aircraft essentially has an unlimited lifespan. It's certified for unlimited. because of the material properties of the composites. It just doesn't degrade like aluminum aircraft does. So that's what we're looking at. That thing could theoretically fly for another 100 years as long as you do the maintenance on it. It's certified for unlimited life. You're not going to get that on any other aircraft. Cessna 172, 152, you just can't get that out of an aluminum aircraft.
So this Beechcraft Starship, this was a civil aviation private airplane, as we would call it. Did it get up high enough where it had pressurization issues?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it had issues, but if you've ever seen a Beech Starship in person, Richard, or you can Google it.
Oh, I know what they look like. They look gorgeous, yeah.
Well,
but they're prop-driven.
Yeah, it's one of these aircraft that has such a mystique around it. It has this mysterious mystique. It's so beautiful, and when it taxis up on a ramp, everyone wants to see it. I interviewed some engineers who worked on the Beech Starship program, and he said that when this thing would pull up, you know, and they were filling it up with gas, the fuel people, when they were coming up to the aircraft, some of these guys were just so awe-inspired by it, they fell off the ladder because it's just so awe-inspiring. It just has some type of mystique about it where it just draws you to it.
Well, it's an airplane that's full of smooth curves. It looks like an alien spacecraft, and you're saying that it's so much easier to do that in composites now than in aluminum.
Well, now in 2019, yeah, it's the only way to go. We can never look back. We cannot go back to pounding rivets through holes in aluminum. We just can't do it. It's just the arcane, obsolete, dinosaur, Model T-type way to build aircraft. We should never return.
Then the Spruce Goose, really, if Hughes had to really put that into you know, operation with its curved and laminated and pre-stressed plywood, I forget what the wood was. It wasn't spruce. It was some other wood. But they literally used these huge hydraulic presses to curve the wood into the shape, and then they glued it all together, so it should have had the same laminar characteristics that composites do now.
In a way, but you're never going to get the level of accuracy you can with composites. Now, if you go to the Smithsonian, and I'm sure you've been there, Richard, where you've seen the Hughes H1 Racer, now they had flush rivets there. That's approaching perhaps what you could get, but you're still never going to get the amount of laminar flow that you can get on a really well-done composite. Although I love the H1 Racer like everybody else, and that thing is really fared in nicely. But bottom line is, composites are the future. It is the future.
So what about some of the – I mean, we're obviously into the engineering of airplanes. We're going to segue to spacecraft shortly. I heard some in the beginning, you know, which is less than 10 years ago now, some weird things about composite. For instance, there was a major aircraft accident coming out of New York a few years ago, and I forget what the aircraft was, but it had a composite vertical stabilizer. And they claimed, I think I remember, they claimed that the aircraft crashed on takeoff because the vibrations, the resonant vibrations, literally split the composites in that huge vertical tail. And without a tail, they had no control and there was no way to get them down safely.
I'm not familiar with – do you know what type aircraft it was?
No, it was a big aircraft. It was one of the largest that Airbus makes, I think.
Okay. Not sure, Richard. Not sure what that would be. But generally speaking, you don't hear about structural failure in composite aircraft because it's all integrated. It's like the tail is talking to the fuselage. And the
this was a composite tail on an aluminum airplane.
Yeah.
See?
Well, maybe there was a
– and it broke off clean at that intersection. So the way they held it on must not have been – very, very safe.
If the entire aircraft was made out of composite, I don't think you'd see that. You won't see a structural failure on a Starship, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, it's where the two met, which of course gave the industry a bad name. And you know, those of us that kind of look at how airplanes are made. So let's move from aircraft into. Have you been involved in any spacecraft programs?
Negative.
Okay.
I have not.
So all your engineering experience, your CAD design, how the thing works is all based on airfoils, things that need air in an atmosphere to fly, and laminar airflow is the bed, all that kind of thing.
Well,
what got you intrigued with the idea there may be exotic aircraft tooling around in the Earth's atmosphere, forget where they're from for a moment, but had nothing to do with standard power plants and standard aerodynamics?
Well, I went to the Air Force Museum, like a lot of other people, and was inspired by those aircraft as well. One thing led to the other. The XB-70.
Was this in Colorado?
Oh, this is back at Wright-Patterson.
Oh, Wright-Patterson, okay.
Where they have the Air Museum there. Now, that is another one of these awe-inspiring aircraft. And when you see that aircraft, they used to park it outside. This is a long time ago, like mid to late 1970s. It used to be parked outside and before they brought it in the hangar now.
What airplane are we talking about?
The North American Aviation XB-70 Valkyrie.
Oh, the Valkyrie.
My God. Yes. It's another one of these awe-inspiring aircraft.
Which was at the cutting edge of engineering at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a huge airplane. It looked like a flying dart. It even had little tiny – it kind of looked like a flying Tyrannosaurus Rex because it had stubby little wings up around the cockpit, two of them called canards.
That's right.
It looked like very bizarre for an airplane. And they lost – I think they lost one in a crash.
That's right.
Not due to its own fault. It was one of the chase aircraft apparently got in the airstream or something. And this was just at the end of when the Air Force was looking at where are we going to have bombers? Are we going to have missiles? And it was at the end of its kind of projected man-bomber role. But I've never seen one up close, but I've seen tons of film. And it's an extraordinary airplane. It looks, as I said, like a huge flying dart.
Richard, I'm not telling you what to do, but you owe it to yourself to go to the Air Force Museum and spend a day. You could spend a day in that hangar alone. Absolutely awe-inspiring aircraft. When you stand next to it, it's just otherworldly. There's no other word to describe it. It's just beyond belief.
It sounds to me you're sounding very similar to Jim Goodall's love affair with the SR-71.
Exactly. Well, it has a similar effect.
Which, by the way, is a miracle in titanium, speaking of metallic aircraft. I mean, how could you create in composite an airplane that literally glows red hot at 80,000 feet as it's screaming through the atmosphere with two huge, huge engines? I mean, you can't really make a composite airplane do that, can you?
Well, they had problems with the paint on the XB-70. It kept on coming off. You can see photos of it with this patchwork paint on it. It just kept coming off at those speeds. So.
And was it built of steel or aluminum?
I think some of it was stainless steel. Well, it had a composite construction to it, and you were talking about the crash. That's when the F-104 inverted and sheared off both verticals, and then it went to a flat spin and crashed near Barstow, California. And I almost got killed trying to find pieces of that thing. So there's a whole backstory there.
Oh, that sounds like another whole show.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway.
So how did you make the trip? You're at the museum there at Wright-Patt, where some very strange things have been reported to have happened over the years.
Mm-hmm.
How did you lift your sights from gorgeous airplanes to – possible spacecraft?
You're talking about some of the other craft that we'll be talking about tonight?
No, I'm talking about the general theme of UFOs.
Oh, UFOs. Okay. Well, sometimes the line is blurred because when you read these reports, and I guess we should talk about the backstory, spend a minute of how we got to some of these reports. Living in the Chicagoland area, I was very close to the Center for UFO Studies, QFOS.
Oh, right. The one that Alan Hynek started.
Yep. J. Allen Hynek's organization. I was within striking range, about an hour away. So I made arrangements with the librarian, and over a period of about 3 years, I went through all close to 50,000 cases that they have there. And it really is 50,000 cases. This is not an exaggeration. There are thousands upon thousands of cases. Now, these are sightings and reports that came into Alan Hynek long after he passed away. They kept sending in things. So long after 86, people continued to send in their sightings. And there would be a report, there'd be a drawing, there'd be a sketch, there'd be artwork, paperwork to back it up, maps. And so when I pulled open these file drawers, there might be maybe 200 to 250 cases which in each of these drawers. I would pick out only the ones that had a good sketch, drawing, text to go with it, and that's how I move forward on the cases.
Yep. So you started looking at the classic UFO reports, and of course Alan was meticulous in getting as much eyewitness data, or you know, sometimes even had physical samples. So you got intrigued with the idea that maybe there were craft that were a little more performing than stuff you'd been working with?
Sure. I had a long interest in aviation before I started going through those files. But seeing those files and then seeing the actual handwritten letters that were sent to Alan Hynek with the sketch of the actual craft, in those cases, you can bank on it. These people aren't lying. They're recording what they saw, and I really think that we can take it to heart and we can have the confidence that they're telling us the truth. I mean, some of these sketches are really detailed, very detailed. I don't think they're lying. I just don't. They're actually reporting what they're seeing.
So you've been looking now in the files and the archives and UFO reports. At what point did you begin to suspect that not everything was, if we're talking about a real physical vehicle, the standard 50s explanation from the 40s or the 50s was, well, maybe they're interplanetary, maybe they're, quote, alien, that kind of thing. When did you get the idea that maybe some of them are made a lot closer to home?
Well, if you look at the flaps of 47 and 52, 52 was even bigger than 47. A lot of these UFOs have been reported.
Now, a flap, it was defined as a huge spike in the number of,
sure.
of witnesses and reports and all that. Okay.
Correct. That's correct. Basically, if you look at the 52 cases, some of these UFOs are reported to come and go as they please. They can materialize and dematerialize as they please. They've been seen going into the ocean, popping out of the ocean, going into space, so that qualifies as a USO. And they've been seen going into the sides of mountains with no impact, no physical effect whatsoever. So I think we could be looking at an interdimensional craft, or we could be looking at a pre-existing, high technologically advanced society that's been on this planet for thousands of years.
When you say been on this planet, are you saying that maybe they live here?
I'm thinking that they're already here. They've been living in the oceans. We've got reports going back to the 1400s where the sailors reported these things popping out of the ocean right next to their craft. This is going back hundreds of years. So, you know, who had the technology to do that hundreds of years ago?
I'll tell you what, hold it there. My guest this morning is Michael Schratt, aerospace historian, who started out in aircraft, a love of airplanes, and migrated in a very interesting way to vehicles that were capable of just a little better performance, like DAW, hypersonic speeds, stopping dead on a dime, making turns that would crush occupants into a thin glutinous mixture on the cockpit walls if they were operating like airplanes do. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Michael in great detail about what it is that he got intrigued with that made him suddenly realize one day, well, maybe these things, some of them at least, are from a lot closer than from here.